You're listening to EPN, the e-podcast network.
Hello, welcome to the Incandescent Radio Show on the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. This is Hope Gibbs, your host from Incandescent Public Relations and Be Incandescent Magazine. We are here today with Yvette Montero Salvatico, the former head of the Future Workforce Insights Division at the Walt Disney Company. There she led the effort to establish an internal area of strategic foresight expertise dedicated to identifying future workforce trends and assessing their potential impact on capital strategies. In 2011, she joined futurist Frank Spencer as a principal at Kedge, a foresight and futures innovation, creativity, and strategic design consultancy. Yvette is an experienced speaker, and we are very pleased and proud to have her as part of our new Incandescent Speakers Bureau. She's addressed large audiences on topics such as business policy, diversity, and foresight. We are so thrilled to have you here on the Incandescent Radio Show, Yvette. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Hope. I'm excited to be here.
And we are very pleased that you're also a columnist in the January 2013 issue of Be Incandescent Magazine, which went live today, January 1st. And our podcast interview will go live on the 14th. So in anticipation of that, we have a bunch of questions to ask you. And we're going to start off talking a little bit about the keynotes that you facilitated for hundreds of audiences. You're an expert in the discussion of the future of talent and learning in the workplace. Tell us about some of your speeches and what you hope audiences will take away.
Well, Hope, as you know, I offer a variety of keynotes. I've done topics ranging from talent, which was sort of where I got my start in foresight within Disney, to innovation. And everything's customized for each audience. We typically leverage the most recent trend scanning that we have in order to provide each audience sort of the latest insights. We don't believe in, you know, offering that laundry list of emerging trends that people generally do in some keynotes. But instead we like to give folks the patterns that are forming from the convergence of the trends. One example is that generation cohort address, that is on the website. It addresses one of the most critical issues that we know are facing companies today, and that's generations in the workforce, from boomers to Gen X to Gen Y to whatever the digital natives are being called today. You know, there's a lot of focus being put on this whole concept of generational warfare. Our research suggests that, you know, that transformational shift that's happening in society and business, along with the convergence of emerging technology, social change, and this entirely new landscape of complexity is actually causing that well-defined concept of the social historical generation that we've been, you know, all known to know about to actually begin to fade. And we believe generations are giving way to actually passion-oriented cohorts. And in this generation cohort speech, as with all my offerings, I want the audience to understand that the trends aren't enough. We need to make sense of the patterns that are emerging from the collision of many trends. And I also hope that they leave empowered to own their future by realizing that their actions today are creating whatever future ultimately unfolds. So in the case of generations, we can flip the idea of generational warfare on its head and think of it instead of as generational cohorts and passion-focused groups. And that would do a lot to alleviate the issues that folks are seeing in the workplace.
That's so interesting. So the future, the generations at play, you're talking about everyone from the current generation, which is the millennials, to the boomers. So tell us a little bit about how they're struggling and what you see as really coming to pass and what companies need to do to address these issues.
Absolutely. Well, it's a great example of, you know, how we've traditionally used sort of industrial age methods and tools to solve whole new problems. So if you take the example of generations in the workforce, there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of books. If you Google right now on Amazon.com, you'll find thousands of books on the topic. And so if it was as easy as sort of that human bingo chart that everybody knows and loves about, you know, how boomers like to receive feedback and how Gen X, you know, doesn't like to receive this or that, we'd all be a lot smarter about generations. The fact of the matter is you can no longer just you know, categorize people based on the year of their birth. It's much more complicated than that. And so what we're finding is that through social media and converging technologies and the social shift that's happening, people are finding commonalities that have nothing to do with their age. So whether you're 8 or 80, if you have a common passion, you can link up online, never even having to see each other. And that's bridging the gap between what we traditionally think of, you know, the generational warfare concept.
And so why do you think the generations are at war or have been? Is it a jealousy thing? Is it a, you know, you can't have my job kind of thing? Or is it just really built into the, you know, what they believe about life and how things are supposed to be at work?
I think it's a combination of things, but I think our processes and our institutions serve to support that generational warfare mentality. If you think about how we, you know, even we have a tool in Foresight called causal layered analysis that really gets at the root cause of some of these issues. And it does so by looking at what's going on beneath the sort of the tip of the iceberg issue. And in this case, we have various myths and metaphors that drive our thinking. And so things like, you know, the wisdom of our elders and children should be seen and not heard. Those things are you know, fundamental in many cultures. And that forms the foundation of how we drive our business results and processes. The idea that you have to earn your wings, you know, all of those sort of phrases come to play. And the fact of the matter is that things are changing so quickly that, you know, the fact that you went to school for many, many years on a topic and have a degree may not be as valuable as it has been in the past because information is being updated so quickly. So we're starting to see a flip in what is really valued, whether it's experience or sort of this, you know, ability to learn, unlearn, and relearn that the younger generations seem to have more so. So the idea is not that one generation is wrong or right. The idea is how do we create a work environment that, you know, creates the future that we want, that empowers the new workers coming in, which we need, that respects the fact that there's folks there that have experience and have knowledge to transfer. And so by changing our thought processes around some of these core myths and metaphors, you can create a whole new work environment that's about people linked around a common passion as opposed to thinking about how much time they put in or what they're owed, et cetera.
That makes perfect sense, and it's so interesting. Talk a little bit about your time in Disney. You worked on a project called Workforce of the Future Initiative, and that provided you with a unique perspective on how to make trends, research, and foresight actually work in the real world. Tell us a little bit about that and how it's playing out in your life currently.
Yeah, well, I worked for Disney for over 13 years, and I wouldn't trade a single second of it for anything. I had always wanted to work for Disney. I was a Disney fan growing up. And, you know, when I finally got the opportunity to work there, you know, it was absolutely a dream come true. Most of the time I spent in finance, but then in that final part of my tenure, I had the opportunity to start the future workforce of the future. And it was really an entire department that I was asked to head up and really create from scratch. The Disney environment is such that, you know, you'll never work with more smarter or challenging people, and that really helps you to up your game. It also teaches you the importance of work relationships. Disney is so large and so complex that it was really about who you knew and not what you knew. So if you wanted to solve a problem, you needed to have, you know, hopefully formed a relationship with somebody in that department so that you could pick up the phone and quickly get a solution. And all those relationships are paying off now as we continue to support Disney from the outside. But really, you know, this initiative, this department served as the training ground for me on how to develop a competency, a foresight competency within a complex environment like a corporation. Traditionally, strategic foresight is a very academic field. It's very complex. It's got its own jargon, complex methodologies. And if you try to introduce something like that into a company like Disney, you'll most likely fail. Disney's got a very strong culture and a way of doing things, and anything from the outside is sort of looked on with some distrust. So we had to make the tools Disney friendly. And one of the most important things I've learned is that you really have to meet people where they are with this work, not sort of where you want them to be. Foresight is really a journey, and everybody's in a different spot. You have to recognize where they're at and adjust the tools and learning for them. So I think the other key thing that I learned in that journey was that that it's all about change management. Instilling this these tools as a competency, as part of the culture, which is the only way for it to be really successful, requires a lot of change management. You have to get it part of already what the processes are already being done, not as another thing on the to-do list, or else it won't succeed. And we've been really excited at Kedge to be able to continue the work I started on the inside from the outside. And ironically, from the outside, we've moved the needle even more. I think because, you know, we have a little bit more ability to be, you know, a little bit more driven in terms of what we can push the client to think about. Since they're not the only ones paying my salary, we can kind of push their thinking in terms of, no, you really need to think about it this way. Plus, we have the opportunity to give Disney perspectives from other clients and experiences we've had elsewhere in other industries that have been really helpful.
That must be very, very, very effective for Disney. And you talk in your January 2013 article, which we've given the headline, "The Future is Not a Footnote." So you talk about being a finance professional at large multinational firms, including Disney, and how the current state of affairs at large corporations is good intentions, poor results. Talk a little bit about the article that you wrote and why you feel that way.
Yeah, I think you know, the idea of the future is not a footnote is really a very common thought and issue in a lot of large companies, and probably a lot of small companies too, although small companies tend to be a little bit more nimble than their large brethren. The idea behind the future is not a footnote is that a lot of times we have processes within finance, really finance-driven, and we're constantly either doing an annual operating plan, a five-year plan, or a forecast. It's just a common thing. It became 365-day-a-year effort, yet we weren't any more prepared for the future because those efforts were driven by Excel spreadsheets and models that are very quantitatively based and based largely on historical performance. And if there's anything that we should have learned since 2008 is that you can't predict the future based on the past. In fact, you can't predict the future at all. And so that's a really hard lesson for folks to learn in this volatile environment. And so as a result, what we're finding is folks sort of clamor on to what's worked in the past even stronger. I say the article, it's sort of their little blankie, you know, that they're holding on to. When in fact, those aren't the tools that'll work in this environment and in the future. Those tools are strategic foresight tools where you can do scenario planning and you can envision multiple futures since we can't predict the future. The idea there is that if you envision multiple futures, your strategy can be resilient no matter what future unfolds. And so we're not saying, you know, get rid of the quant data because we know that that's not reasonable or, you know, something that you want to do regardless. There's still a place for quant data. The idea, though, is that there's a qualitative component and there's these foresight tools that form a very strong partnership with the existing tools to morph them to make them much more reliable and effective in the current volatile environment that we're in.
It's so interesting, and your perspective is really interesting. Tell us how you got to be a futurist.
Well, I think I was a futurist for a long time and just didn't know it. When I started the foresight initiative within Disney, I didn't really know what strategic foresight was. The idea behind the group was our, you know, chief human resource officer for the Walt Disney Company knew that we need to have a focus on the future as it related to our human capital strategies. And she knew my work from finance, so she appointed me the lead. And in doing research and in working with external partners, I discovered this discipline called strategic foresight. But then realized that I had a lot of the skill sets, you know, curiosity, and, you know, analytical ability, the desire to create stories around the future, And in dealing with clients since then, I think there's a lot of folks that are really futurists and don't know it. And when they're trained and sort of introduced to these tools, a whole new world opens up for them, as it did for me. And I believe foresight and being a futurist is really my passion and my calling, which is why ultimately I made that difficult decision to leave Disney, even though, you know, I loved working for Disney. I had interviewed pretty much every futurist in the field within my role at Disney, looking for external partners, and we partnered with a lot of them. But it was when I met Frank Spencer from TED that the light really went on, and he just had incredible experience about creating this competency within an organization and helped move the work forward immensely in the time that we partnered with them. With him and Kedge. And so when Frank came to me and said, you know, I'm growing by leaps and bounds and I'm thinking about bringing in a partner, he and I had clicked so well, sort of personally, had such a great working relationship that I did some soul searching and thought about it. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I think the other thing that was really unique about my time at Disney is creating that foresight division made me realize that I not only loved foresight, but I also had this entrepreneurial spirit within me that I had no idea I had. And as you can imagine, you know, a company like Disney is great and you have great opportunities, but you can't always create things from scratch. There's a reason why it's been around for a long time and things work really, really well. And so what I love about my opportunity as a partner at Kedge is that we could create strategy and help many, many clients along with Disney. So I've kind of got a great deal here. I've got my cake and I can eat it too. Still working with Disney in much wider capacity than even was when I was on the inside, because I'm working with every segment now. Plus, I get to work with other organizations and own my own company. So I'm having a great time.
That's terrific. Tell us a little bit about what you guys hope to do with Kedge.
Kedge is such a big part of who I am and you know, where I see my future for the foreseeable future that I'm going to be a career person. Kedge is a really unique firm. It is a foresight firm, but it's also an innovation firm. And, you know, we have several key principles and a very strong company culture that we've developed and that Frank's done a great job developing, and I've joined in on that. One is that, you know, we feel very strongly about teaching our clients how to fish. We have all participated in keynotes and speeches where it's just sort of the list of trends and here's my forecast. And while that's all great, the important thing is that we sort of create this opportunity for clients to have that skill going forward, because a powerful keynote only has a certain, you know, shelf life. But if we can give folks a toolkit, they can fish for themselves after we leave. I think the other, you know, strong thing about Kedge and our company culture can best be described with our name. And the name Kedge actually comes from an anchor, the name of an anchor on an old sailing vessel. Back when sailing vessels didn't have any motors whatsoever and there wasn't that opportunity, if there was no wind and the boat was sort of, you know, trapped and stopped there at because they didn't have any wind, they would send a couple of the sailors out on a rowboat in the direction that they wanted to ultimately go with this Kedge, this smaller anchor. And miles out, they would drop this anchor down, and then the folks left on the boat would pull themselves towards that spot. So in essence, that's what we want to do at Kedge. We want to make sure that we not only tell people what's happening with the trends, but more importantly, help them identify those aspirations, that future that they want, to help them create it and pull themselves forward.
That's very, very cool. Tell us also a little bit about what it is that you're forecasting for 2013, as you encourage people to do more of this, and what do you see on the landscape for corporations and also small business owners?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's lots of things going on, you know, whether it's social media and technology, this social shift that we have seen happening since 2008, all of these things are converging, and that's the powerful aspect, is that because of technology, because of globalization, everything's sort of converging. You can no longer look at trends in isolation. So we do a lot of work with our clients, for example, with trend cards, where we have them look at cards independently and then think about how those trends could mesh and create whole new worlds of opportunities. I think the most important forecast that I can share with anyone for 2013, which I can't believe it's already 2013, or beyond, is that their organizations are going to continue to need individuals with resilience. And by resilience, we mean that ability to learn, unlearn, and relearn. It's really the new leadership competency of the 21st century. And they need that coupled with the skill of future thinking. Every organization should be cultivating a culture of future thinkers if they want to be successful. They don't want to end up being the next Kodak. They need every single one of their employees thinking in this way. You know, we're in an environment where chaos and complexity is the new normal. There is not going to be another normal like we've known it. And only those organizations that cultivate that future thinking culture are going to survive. And so, I think that there's a book written about trends about every 15 minutes or so. So if it was just about, you know, these forecasts and reading about these forecasts, we'd all be better prepared for the future. I'd much rather folks stop buying those books on trends, stop booking those trend keynotes, and instead look to let us partner with them to help them build the capacity to create whatever future they want, and not just let those trends come at them and be reactionary, but instead look at those trends as a potential landscape of opportunity to create the aspirational future they want by interpreting and analyzing and capitalizing on those trends for themselves. If that would be the ideal forecast for every organization, the ability to do that would make them successful no matter what happened in the future.
That's great. What do you forecast is the future for you and for Kedge?
Well, we are still growing, and there's going to be a lot of international travel this next year. So folks need to be patient with us because we probably will not be in their time zone and suffering from a lot of jet lag in the next few months. We have two trips to Asia as well as a trip to Europe planned in the next 2 months. Where we're helping an organization build a global futures team. And so we're excited because, you know, futures thinking is the great cultural equalizer. We're going to train folks in Japan, in China, in Russia, and all using the same toolkit. So we're creating a common language for this organization that's going to be really powerful for their strategic planning efforts and beyond. Beyond that, we're excited to launch our Wicked Opportunities program and are writing a book around that program. And Wicked Opportunities is premised on the fact that we are surrounded with these wicked problems right now, the problems that when you try to solve them, you create three more problems. But we really think that you can flip the idea of wicked problems on their heads and create wicked opportunities. And through meshing transdisciplinary folks from different backgrounds, and leveraging the trends and really moving from, you know, just iterative innovation, like I want it in blue, I want the screen, you know, 3 millimeters larger. Instead of innovating in that way, we teach clients how to transform their invention. And we do that through foresight in this Wicked Opportunities program. But it's a great program for entrepreneurs, as well as we've used it within, you know, established organizations as part of their leadership program. So it's a great program, and hopefully the book will be out this year, and we hope to offer several standalone offerings for entrepreneurs to come in and learn the skill of innovating in the 21st century.
It sounds very exciting, and we look forward to that and also being part of that, helping people understand more about their Wicked Opportunities. So we'll have you back on to talk more about that in the very near future. And also, we'd love to have you write an article about Wicked Opportunities and an upcoming issue. So we'll talk more about that offline. For now, we just thank you so much for your time here on New Year's Day, January 1st, 2013, when we launched this issue of The Incandescent Magazine, featuring Yvette and also having her on our Incandescent Speakers Bureau. If you want to learn more about Yvette and Kedge, go to www.kedgefutures.com. You can also visit her page on incandescentspeakers.com and in the January issue of theincandescent.com. Thank you again for being here, Yvette.
Thank you, Hope. I appreciate. I'm thankful to be here and appreciate the opportunity to talk with your readers and to reach folks in this brand new year of 2013.
Yes, here's to all good things coming. This is Hope Gibbs with the Incandescent Radio Show on the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Be sure to tune in every Monday at noon when we launch a new episode of the Incandescent Radio Show on www.epodcastnetwork.com. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for your time.
This is the ePodcast Network.